Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hellig. I am head of Insight Life Solutions. And today we have an episode of the Open Books series where we talk to fascinating and inspirational actuaries about the books that they have read and loved. Today, I'm joined by Rosanne Harris. Rosanne is a healthcare actuary. She studied at BITS, where she still teaches, and she qualified in 1996. Rosanne has been very active in the actuarial profession and at various times has chaired the Health Committee, the Transformation Committee, Tuition Committee, and the Education Board of ASSA. She was ASSA President in 2016 and 2017. She's also been active in the International Actuarial Association and was IAA President for 2022. Rosanne currently works at Discovery Health, where she heads up the Policy and Regulatory Affairs Unit, and she is also an adjunct professor in the School of Statistics and Actuarial Science at BITS. In 2023, Rosanne was awarded the Murray Medal, which is the highest honor that ASSA can bestow on any of its members. In fact, it's only been awarded 20 times since its establishment in 1972. Rosanne has two daughters. Stephanie is also an actuary, and Laura is doing her master's in economics. Welcome, Rosanne.
Thank you.
That's quite an intro. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's been like fascinating to get myself ready for this. I've had to do a lot of thinking.
Yeah, not so easy to narrow it down, but tell me, do you love reading?
I do love reading. I mean, it's funny. I remember when I was little, you know, when people say, what are your hobbies? I'd always say reading. And then it was reading like Famous Five. And so, yeah, no, I've always enjoyed reading.
But I'm so glad that you are such a passionate reader, because this podcast is a little bit different from the traditional interview format in that we will be talking to you about your career and the things that you're busy with, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you. So before we get into the books, tell me, what is keeping you busy these days?
Well, there's three letters right now that are keeping me busy, and that's NHI. Oh, yeah, the nightmare. So it's been really interesting, actually, being part of this whole journey and all of these discussions this way and that way, quite frustrating at times. But, I mean, my role at Discovery in terms of policy and regulatory work has been quite dominated by the regulatory developments around NHI and particularly in the last year. So you know, I have enjoyed it as much as it's been frustrating and tiring at times. And then other than that, you know, obviously still my role in the International Actuarial Association. So you know, that also has taken quite a lot of time. I'm kind of in the tail end of that now, so it's winding down, and of course what we've been working on there is taking stock as well post the pandemic, is how that's changed the way we think about actuarial practice, and then always the work at WITS and working with the students, which always inspires me and keeps things fresh. So yeah, lots on the go.
And quite a nice variety of things as well. I think we will get into all of those things in the interview, but I think the immediate and urgent question on everyone's mind is, you know, what should South Africans know about the latest development in NHI? How does that affect us? And to give context, we are a few days post-election, after an eventful month of May. So what would you tell the average South African?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the important thing is that NHI, or the passing of the NHI bill and now the NHI Act, it unfortunately actually doesn't really have any immediate consequence in terms of delivery of healthcare in South Africa. There's a massive amount of work that needs to happen. In fact, no sections of the Act have been given effective dates yet. But there's a massive amount of work that has to be done in terms of establishing the NHI fund as an entity and reorganizing the public sector. And I guess it's frustrating because there's so much we could be doing that that could have an immediate impact on expanding access to care, and not in a way that's inconsistent with the trajectory or the intended trajectory of the NHI. So it's frustrating that we seem to be having all these, you know, almost theoretical debates while Rome burns in a way. So I think there's going to be a lot of noise around this still, and it's important to stress that there's no changes to medical scheme benefits. There's also no changes to taxes. It's only National Treasury that can change the taxes, and unfortunately, the funding requirements are so large that the tax amounts are completely unrealistic. And we do need to rather be focused, instead of something that is pretty pie in the sky. We need to be focused on what we can do with what we have got and what is within our reach. So that's where I'm trying to corral the conversation.
Thank you, Rosanne. Hopefully that's given a bit of context to people who aren't as involved as you are in discussions. But we will get to more of that a bit, in a bit. But before that, I'd like to ask a bit about your reading habits. That's a lot more fun to talk about. So what genres do you tend to read?
Yeah, I had a look. So I have my sort of library shelf. So I was having a look at the books that I have there, and it's actually quite a range. I mean, the author that I actually have the most books of is John Grisham. So I suppose that gives you some insight into saying, well, I suppose these kind of like crime courtroom books are interesting to me, but I do also like, you know, just that summer reading, you know, the sort of the family saga reading. So I also enjoy Jodi Picoult books that kind of make you think as well, but are a good story.
So what is your perfect reading setting?
Yeah, I think somewhere in nature. Maybe beside a pool, or with some running water. Maybe beside a river, on a in a comfortable lounging chair, and also with my loved ones around. I like when I've got the downtime. It's nice to sort of know that the people that I love and care about are also enjoying that with me.
Okay, so shall we talk about the first book you brought along today?
Yes, let me put in my pile.
Do I have a visual aid? Oh, yeah. Wow.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
Let's start with Stephen Covey.
There, right. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Yeah, tell me about, you know, what do you love about this book?
Well, the interesting thing about these books is kind of how they came to me as well. So this book was given to me by a lady called Kathy Wallstead Plum, and she was the CEO of this joint venture between United Healthcare and Southern Life and Anglo American that aimed to bring managed care to South Africa. Now, nothing united the doctors more than an American company bringing managed care to South Africa back in 1996. And I just qualified at that stage, and she had this kind of expat management team, and the idea was there was going to be this South African team underneath them, who then, when they sort of moved away and back to the US, would then sort of take the reins of running the company that they'd set up with all their US sourced wisdom. So she gave the management team this book. And it was I just qualified, so it was good timing for me to think about, you know, how to organize myself a bit better as I move from sort of being focused on the studying into being more focused on work. And also at that stage I was juggling as a working mom, so I had those kind of time pressures as well. So, you know, it actually was quite helpful in terms of just giving me some really practical pointers about how to balance things and how to sort of balance the way I think about things as well. So I'd say there were like two key lessons that really resonated with me in this book. So the first one was this concept of a circle of influence, right? So we worry about all these things, but there's this like circle of influence that are things that we can actually do something about. And if we spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, things that we can't do much about, then, you know, we get anxious about it, but it doesn't have an effect. Whereas if we focus our energies, you know, on things that we can actually make a change to and on expanding the circle of influence. So I guess that's what's guided me, is making sure that, you know, my sort of my worrying, and I'm a very good worrier, my worrying is about things that I can influence. And then my work is about then trying to expand my influence so that I can make a change. So that was the one thing that really resonated with me in the book. And then the second one was the quadrants of how to spend your time. You know, so there's important and not important, and then there's urgent and not urgent. And we tend to get sucked into things that are not important but urgent. And we need to be actually prioritizing obviously the important and urgent. And what comes next is the important but not urgent, rather than the urgent. And it can be sometimes quite a discipline when you look at your to-do list and say, yes, I know that someone is waiting for this, but actually I need to make sure that I'm spending time on this thing which is not urgent but still important.
And you know, you've served in many leadership roles throughout your career, possibly all the leadership roles as an actuary. So have you also applied these lessons or any of the habits to how you lead teams or lead people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in terms of juggling, because I always find myself in a position where I don't have one job. You know, I'm always doing lots of things. And then, of course, there's my most important job, which is being a mom, and actually now also being a granny, a very important job. And how do I balance those things against work things? So there's that balance, but also, as you say, in a leadership role, when there's lots of demands on your attention and also lots of things that you want to do, when you get into a leadership position, you think of all the things that you can do with having that that position, and I find that these things really do help to prioritize, so focus on the things that where you can make a difference in your circle of influence, or on expanding that circle of influence. You know, for us as a profession, for example, where are the places that we have credibility that we can influence change, but where are the things where we should have credibility, where, you know, and we can expand our circle of influence and pave the way to make a change in the future. So absolutely, these are very practical tools.
Can you think of any examples where you've expanded your circle of influence when it comes to actuarial work?
The obvious one is healthcare. When I first started working, I mean, it was not a normal area of practice, and it was actually seen as a wider field for quite a large proportion of my career. When we talked about wider fields, actually healthcare was in there. So in a similar way to, I suppose, we've thought about banking and then data science, that's where healthcare was when I first started out. And so, you know, in a way, it has been a case of establishing how actuaries add value in the healthcare space. And I think, to me, the sort of the next step from that is a broader social security context that actuaries can add value in the space of social security. I mean, we often have these debates about the public interest and so forth. And I think we need to maybe concretize that a bit more in terms of actually what we can do to make social security more sustainable and have a greater reach, particularly in an economy like ours where we have such massive inequality.
How can we do that work? Would that require collaboration with the government, or, you know, who should be taking the lead there to make it happen?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of both, right? We have to have a meeting of the minds. I think we need to be clear about the skills that we have that are relevant and be quite deliberate in in communicating that to the stakeholders that matter, and very often that is that is in government, but also in civil society. Because you do have a lot of people who are sort of promoting the need for support, and who are concerned about societal issues, but don't necessarily have the skills to be able to solve those problems. So I think it's broader than just partnering with government. I think it's also being a part of a community that is addressing some of these problems and bringing our skill set to that. I mean, we can't sweep in and say, look, we've got all the answers, but bringing our skill set to helping to solve those problems. Because I think our skill set, although, there's the financial management and planning and all of that part of our skill set, but there's also just a way that we approach problem solving as actuaries, gathering information and understanding the problem and making assumptions and testing those assumptions. There's a way that we think about solving problems that means that we can apply that not just to financial issues, but perhaps to broader issues that will help to sort of bridge the gap between where there's kind of a big need and what our resources can cover.
So the next book we're going to talk about is Thinking Fast and Slow. Is it Daniel Kahneman? Do you have that one with you?
I do. Also very well thumbed with lots of little markers in it.
Okay, how would you summarize this
book? So the reason I chose this book, how would I summarize this book? I would say it's a brilliant book about how to think more effectively. It's actually what it is about mindfulness in how you think. I mean, and it's hard for us as people who are so analytical to sort of bring that mindfulness part in, because often when you talk about being mindful, it actually, people think about it, well, that's when you're not thinking, when you're meditating and you're not thinking. But actually it's about thinking about the way you think while you're thinking. And it has relevance in all sorts of things. I mean, like even a concept like unconscious bias is about actually slowing down and saying, why am I thinking this way? Am I making assumptions that are all the assumptions I'm making, are they relevant and appropriate? So it's actually a book about being mindful in how you think.
How do you practice mindfulness day to day? Do you meditate or do you have other kind of techniques?
I so wish I had time to meditate. My brother has been trying to get me into this, and I don't know how he finds the time, but I wish I had time to do that. I have to tell you, it's because it is about taking yourself, out of it. So I find things like my running, when I put on my running shoes and go for a run, a lot of things fall into place in my head when I have my running shoes on, and I'm moving my legs, obviously, not just wearing them. I find that you have to do both. It's not just the magic shoes.
Oh no.
So I do find that that's a helpful way. And and also, just, I mean, silly things like singing along to music on the radio is just a way to take you out of yourself. you know, getting up and going for a walk, or catching up with people, you know, those, I find those are the things that then, you know, take me out of being sort of sucked into a problem and give me the space to actually see the things that are the most important.
Okay. And what's the third book we're going to talk about today?
Well, I'm thinking about whether we should go back in time or forward in time, but maybe we should go into fiction. And I should explain to you why I have this book.
Yes, please.
So
that is Circle of Friends by Maeve Binchy.
Maeve Binchy, yeah. And this is that category of book where I read it and then it was made into a movie. And I kind of enjoyed the movie, but it just wasn't enough. There's more in the book. And the reason I put this book on my list is for two reasons. The first is that Maeve Binchy, of course, an Irish author, and I have an Irish heritage, so I was born a Murphy, and so I guess there's, you know, I read a lot of Maeve Binchy books and other Irish authors resonate with me, but also because when I was growing up, my mum read for tape aids for the blind, and because she had a little bit of an Irish lilt, they would give her the Maeve Binchy books to read. So my mom read a whole stack of the Maeve Binchy books for the blind. And she went through from having those big roller tapes and to right up to the digital age where she could almost do it at home and she didn't have to go and sit in a studio. And so that was the one reason I chose this book. It was, you know, the Irish heritage of my mom. And the other reason is because the nice thing about this story is it really highlights how complicated life can be. And, you know, that, and that having friends and sort of having the true friends that last through thick and thin with all those shared experiences and riding the complications of life, really, and so it's a good reminder that, you know, as much as we have our habit of starting with the end in mind, that the journey that takes that life takes us on is sometimes a little bit more colorful and circuitous than we imagined at the beginning. And I guess in my case, I didn't imagine that you know, I would be a mum at the age of 20, and you know, that wasn't part of the grand plan, but you know, looking back now, super glad that happened, and that I have my Steph who's also an actuary now, and of course now is a mum herself and dealing with all those challenges, and as you know, I've been a Murphy, and then I was a De Silva, and then I became a Harris. So lots of complications along the way, where, you know, you learn a little bit about yourself as you go as well. So even though, you know, life is not a smooth journey, it's still a very interesting journey, and that's, I guess, what this book is about.
In 1996, qualifying as a female actuary must have been quite different from how it is today. What was it like being a female actuary in those times, almost 30 years ago? And how do you think the profession has transformed since then?
Yeah, it's such an interesting one. So when I qualified in 1996, I think I was the 19th female actuary in the South African profession. So when I went to the convention, I didn't have to queue for the loo, which was the a big benefit, because right now you do, and I love standing in the queue for the loo at actuarial events, because it does remind me how the profession has changed. We've kind of plateaued, though. I mean, I don't know if you realize that. I mean, when I was president, I remarked about the fact that there were as many female actuaries as there were total actuaries in the profession. When I qualified, I felt that was progress, but we've kind of plateaued at around this kind of 32%, 32% level. So about a third of our profession are women. And I think we need to understand that, you know, we need to understand why. But as you say, it was a very male dominated profession. And I guess as much as it was, I suppose, a challenge, it wasn't something that I took on. You know, I didn't feel at the time like I was breaking boundaries. I think it was just because, you know, it was a bit complicated for me. I mean, I was a young mother as well, and I just kind of put my head down and thought, I'm just going to do the very best I can, and my focus was on doing the best I can for Steph and for my family, and I didn't really battle against it. You know, I mean, obviously I dealt with things like where, I mean, I often tell the story, I'd go into meetings, you know, and the assumption would be I'm there to make the tea or take notes. And, you know, when I'm the one who's then giving the presentation, and you can see people like, you know, your choice is to call it out and to say, yeah, I bet you think I can't do this. Or to just actually do it really well. And see that transformation happen, and know that then the next time that person sees a woman walking in the room to do the presentation, you know, maybe they don't have that doubt. And that was the approach that I adopted, because I found that, you know, the sort of aggression causes fear, and it's a vicious cycle, and it doesn't actually achieve the transformation that you're seeking, right? Where we get judged on what we do. But I guess in retrospect, when I look back and you know, I listen a lot to and I participate a lot in these conversations. When I look back, you know, there was a lot of adapting that I did that perhaps nowadays you would be less inclined to just adapt, you know, that kind of fitting in and trying to make it work. And I think, you know, we live in a more inclusive world now, which is better. And I would say that the thing was that I just had to work that much harder to get over that initial hurdle of proving that I can, because I guess I had both of those things, right? The, you know, being a woman and also being a mother. You know, can you compete in this environment? But I think what also helped me was that, you know, when I, after I qualified, I started working on my own and it wasn't the grand plan, but I became an independent consulting actuary, which gave me more flexibility, and also I was sort of more self-reliant, and I was judged then on what I was producing, what I was doing, as opposed to, you know, being in a corporate environment. And I think that helped as well. So that's a bit of a rambling answer, but.
Yeah, I think one of my first, memories of seeing you or being in your presence was, must have been a number of years ago at the ASTA convention after a session on transformation. And I remember you saying that there is that tension between wanting to transform and make the profession more inclusive, but not at the expense of anyone else's dignity. And that's always stuck with me. So, you know, do you think that we need to increase that 33%? And that's, it's interesting because I, you know, when I was graduating, in 2008, that was the number at that time as well. It's interesting that it hasn't moved on.
Yeah.
Do we need to make an effort to increase that percentage no matter what? Or how do we kind of gently encourage that number upwards?
Yeah, I'm in the gently encouraging camp, because I get nervous about percentages, because as you say, the problem with percentages is that it makes some people feel unwelcome or unwanted, you know, like they're skewing the numbers. And the thing is that as a profession, as we've said earlier, we have so much to contribute to solving the big problems. We need more people, and we need people who are thinking about how to solve those problems. That's the most important thing. People who are, you know, who are willing and diligent and ethical, and, you know, those are the people that we need. And, you know, in a way, what they look like doesn't necessarily diminish their ability to help everybody, to help, you know, the full spectrum of society. And so, you know, I would hate to think that because now we're fixated on numbers, that you know, that the male actuaries who are qualifying, for example, feel that, oh well, if I hadn't have qualified, you know, this year, then this the percentage would have been higher. So I'm in the camp of sort of, well, let's understand the challenges, and we should be thinking about numbers. You know, how can we get more women qualifying? And how can we encourage women to be part of our profession? I mean, it's interesting that there's other countries where they have the opposite problem. You know, in the Caribbean, they actually seriously have a program about how can they get more men to study actuarial science. I mean, it's completely reversed. Even in Eastern Europe. In countries like Estonia, and one of the issues that they've identified there is that the universities tend to get separated into kind of the sort of more arts and then the science, and economics and actual science sit on the arts side and not the science side. And because then societally women get channeled in that direction, they actually have more female actuaries than male actuaries. So it's amazing the dynamics. So, you know, so I think, again, I suppose being mindful about it and mindful about how we convey what we're trying to achieve, that we don't actually have the effect of discouraging people who can actually help with the broader challenges.
I'm blown away by actuarial science being classified as an arts degree. Yeah, it just shows you, you know, what's in the name, you know, how we categorize something. Yeah. Actually, you know, makes, yeah, you know, it has a huge impact. Okay, what's the fourth book we're going to talk about today?
So which one have we not covered? Okay, so there's this one, which is Justice by Edwin Cameron. I read this book just after Fees Must Fall, which was quite a traumatic period for me because, you know, obviously on campus I was caught up in all of that, and Edwin Cameron was, of course, you know, leading the WITS council at that stage as well. So there was that WITS link, and I really enjoyed this book from the point of view of his humility. In how he writes, it was a really, I guess, inspiring to just the way that he wrote his story with such humility and dignity, and also how it was that the events that he was writing about were, you know, also important in my career. So, you know, one of the big issues and. That he writes about, of course, is you know, the battle to get antiretrovirals. Well, first of all, to get HIV and AIDS recognized as a real thing, and the antiretroviral treatment program, you know, so that, you know, was a big part of particularly when I was consulting. That was a big issue at that time, and even you know, he writes about the Subramani case, which was about the constitutional right of access to healthcare. So you know, that's a case that I refer to quite a lot, especially recently when we're thinking about Section 27 of the Constitution. So you know, so those events that kind of were very significant in his legal career were also significant events in my actuarial career. I mean, obviously at a different stage in my career than his, and just, you know, understanding the challenges that that someone like Edwin Cameron had coming from, I mean, incredibly humble beginnings, how he lifted himself up by his bootstraps literally, and of course dealing with the challenges of his own personal journey of at what point did he declare not only his personal sexual status, but also when he declared that he was HIV positive. I mean, it was only once he was in the Constitutional Court. I never realized that that he actually went public about his HIV positive status. So yeah, I mean, I found this book really, really inspiring. I read it slowly because it was a very inspiring story and also resonated so much with me in terms of the events.
What was the Supermoney case?
So the Supermoney case was back in, I think it was 98 or 99. And it was a case about a guy who was on dialysis, this guy Supermoney, and he was, or he needed dialysis, and he was denied access on the basis that he had other comorbidities. And so it went to the Constitutional Court in terms of whether the provision in Section 27, which says within available resources, actually has weight. So what does that mean? Does it give scope to the Department of Health to have criteria that can be applied to say, well, actually, because we have finite resources, we can't address all the health needs. We need to make rationing decisions. So when we have something that is an expensive intervention like dialysis, you know, do we get to define the criteria on which we apply? And it went all the way to the Constitutional Court. And sadly, in fact, when the ruling was issued, Subramani had actually died by that stage. But the ruling upheld that the Department of Health was within its was consistent with the constitutional obligation, saying that they had on an evidence basis decided that it didn't make sense for them to use the scarce finite resources available for funding health for that particular patient, and that they could therefore it upheld sort of making the kind of rationing decisions that are required to be, you know, because fair and equitable, what does that mean? Does that mean that everybody who needs it has access, or is there some kind of prioritization? And when you have scarce resources, if you don't do that, then the alternative is it's actually just random, like first come, first serve type thing. So so it was quite a groundbreaking, and in fact, you know, will be, I think, a reference point in the litigation that's going to follow on the NHI Act. I mean, the other judgment he also makes reference to in here, which you may have heard of, is people talk about the Grootboom judgment as well, which is actually not about health at all, but about housing. And it's a constitutional judgment that is it's about whether you can take the rights away from one group in order to promote the rights of another group, and also whether the government can sort of usurp your right to provide for yourself. I mean, if you've got the means to provide for yourself, can they usurp that right? So those are important constitutional fundamentals, I think, that have relevance in the current NHI debate. As well, but this book is actually, I mean, it's a really, really touching story.
Well, speaking of constitutional issues, I guess the other major healthcare and actuarial related saga that we've been through, and probably post the publication of this book, was COVID, of course. So how can you tell us a bit about what your role was during, the COVID pandemic? And I believe that was also a time when you were busy on the International Actuarial Association. So what was that like?
Yeah, well, a lot to unpack around that. But I guess, I mean, in terms of, obviously working for the largest health administrator, it was a health crisis was a big issue for us, and so it was a case of all hands on deck in terms of understanding the risk as it unfolded, and I was part of that initial group that got together in the Actuarial Society to form sort of like a task team to share information as it came to light. So, you know, as our team here at Discovery was collecting information, then, you know, we were sharing it with, I mean, Barry was just instrumental in driving that forward, Barry Childs, and got recognized with the President's Award for that. Very deservedly so, in terms of bringing everyone together and aiming for the profession to make a positive contribution as kind of all this information unfolded. And then, of course, I got roped in by Adrian to the vaccine project. So we started working on that late in 2020 as to sort of providing input on, first of all, how we could source these. And then, you know, it was a case of sourcing the vaccines, but also doing the work around the priority setting and making sense of the information that we did have around severity and where the vaccines would have a positive effect, and matching that up with the need in the population, and of course then the logistics. So I was involved in the B4SA project then, which, I mean, if you told us back in say November of 2020 that the rollout would only start in May of 2021, I think we would have just cried. But yeah, it was a big effort, and of course dealing through all of that with the naysayers.
Gosh.
You know, so frustrating, all the energy that we had to put into you've got so much to just keep driving things forward, and then, you know, it felt like we had people sort of anchoring us, holding us back, and that's I would say been very, very frustrating. And still people who are so desperate to find the evidence to substantiate the position that they took initially. I mean, you can understand people's anxiety and concern at the beginning of the pandemic about the extent of the kind of interventions and whether or not they were all necessary, and we can have those debates. But when it came to questioning the medical science and all of that, you know, when, as the evidence unfolds, just, you know, adapt your position. But people who sort of hung on to those positions and are still desperately seeking the evidence to substantiate and hoping that we'll all drop dead at some point because we took those vaccines. I mean, it's just very frustrating.
I feel like I learned so much about human nature during that time, which, you know, you're mentioning all these events and they feel so long ago now.
It does.
Like, did that really happen? But do you think...
Yes. I mean,
you know, when the whole anti-vax thing came about, I thought, gosh, have we not learned from all past pandemics and epidemics where we've had vaccines and how that's, you know, destroyed these
issues? I remember
that.
Yes, well, that presentation that you did at the virtual convention with your mum, that was amazing. It was amazing. Because you really, I mean, you in such a clear way called out, you know, so much of this noise that was just actually getting in the way of helping people. And, you know, all of these allegations and assertions that efforts to help people were, you know, I mean, I don't know, was it that people just couldn't identify with the fact that, you know, when you see people in pain around you, like your instinct is to try and help. And that's all it is. And it's not about having some perverse, you know, world dominating or being influenced by powers of world domination. It's just actually about wanting to help. And it actually felt to me so sad that people couldn't see that there must be an ulterior motive.
Yeah.
So as you say, I mean, it showed us a lot about the polarized human nature, those people who seem to have that gene and those who don't.
Do you think we have learned anything that, you know, will apply to the next pandemic? Or do you think we will kind of go around the same conversations every time?
You know, one of the things I feel most disappointed about is that, is that that sense of collaboration and pulling together, and that, you know, health as a sector here in South Africa, recognizing, you know, that principle of no one's safe until we're all safe, and that applies beyond just the pandemic, but to healthcare more broadly, and that spirit of cooperation and collaboration that emerged between the public and private sectors. I feel so sad, especially in the last couple of weeks, that, you know, with all this really toxic rhetoric around, you know, the only reason people are opposing NHI is, you know, because of, I mean, even going as far as saying that it's a race issue or it's a privilege issue, as opposed to actually, no, it's about caring about people getting access sooner rather than later, because that's when the care is needed. And this notion that, you know, just because you work in the private sector means that you're not able to think that way, you know, that you must have ulterior motives because you work in the private sector. And even those allegations within our profession, that, you know, if you're working in the private sector, you must prove that you are not biased. The assumption is you're biased, and you must prove that you're not biased, as opposed to, you know, that we are all professionals. And when we contribute to our profession, that is how it has worked for hundreds of years. And that's the code that we've signed up for. So, you know, unless there's evidence to the contrary, we should be assuming that everybody is giving their professional best.
Well, speaking of human nature, I guess, and, you know, government and politics and the way people think, shall we talk about the fifth book that you brought along, or haven't brought along, but we're going to talk about today?
Yes, I have. Yeah. So when I was looking for Animal Farm, I found 1984 in my bookshelf.
So between the two of us, we have the whole thing.
Between the two of us, we have, yeah. But I'm trying to think when I read Animal Farm, but it was probably around maybe not 1984, maybe it was 1985, but it was around then. So, you know, what Animal Farm introduced me to was this concept of socialism, you know, and all these wonderful principles that then, you know, go horribly awry when they become sort of wrapped into to human nature or animal nature, as the parallel goes. So, it really opened my eyes. I mean, it opened my eyes to be thinking about these principles of how we organize ourselves socially. I mean, that's, you know, back in 1985, I was like 14, 15, and you know, it was really what triggered me to be thinking about, you know, how do we structure things. And if you think about at that time, I mean, you know, the other side of the coin at that time was Wall Street, actually the original Wall Street with Michael Douglas, you know, and those, like, the toxic capitalism. And so it was interesting to read this parable that was written in the 1940s, I think. And essentially it's a parable about the Russian Revolution, and but it's set on a farm in England where the pigs take over, and of course it's built initially on these egalitarian principles, and then of course, you know, the need for privilege, and all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, takes hold, and we see that, right, in terms of how we structure ourselves, and in a way, you know, over my career, it's actually been quite pleasing to see this sort of emergence of like a social form of capitalism.
Who do you think should read Animal Farm? Who stands to benefit from it? Not a specific person, but what type of person?
I can think of a few specific people. Maybe we should post off some copies, but
Subtle hints.
I think it's I think it's a I mean it's a it's it is a very salutary lesson, I guess, and it's because it's so accessible in terms of how it all pans out. And of course, that the thing at the end is that that the animals the animals sort of get together with the humans on the neighboring farm, and they all are playing cards,
Man.
and you can't tell the difference between who are animals and who are people ultimately. And I mean, isn't that true? When you see in government people with their sort of social leanings, but their Louis Vuitton luggage, and when the money that is pilfered for that would have been for social benefit, is used for sort of non-constructive means. I mean,
No.
it really resonates. So I mean, maybe this should be a reading for all the new members of parliament that get sworn in 10 days' time, right? Maybe they should be required to learn the lessons of history, so we don't have to repeat them.
I think, yeah, it gave me goosebumps now because I think that's how the book ends, right? Where the animals are looking through the window and they can't tell the difference between the pigs and the humans, which is, not the most hopeful note to end on. But, do you have, speaking of socialism and things like that and NHI, what kind of hopeful things can we look forward to with, the NHI Act and anything that's going to come from that?
So I mean, I must say though, I feel, and maybe by the time by the time this goes out, I feel optimistic right now. I mean, I feel like, the way we felt back in 1994. I mean, I remember that election in 1994. I mean, it was pretty scary at the time, because there were the battles that were happening between the IFP and the ANC, and we didn't even know. I mean, up until I think, in fact, the election, the ballot papers had to be reprinted to bring the IFP onto the ballot papers. I recall there was
Okay.
it was you know it was pretty nail biting stuff in terms of whether we were going to fall over the precipice into these massive battles, or become the Rainbow Nation. And we did, right? We did become the Rainbow Nation, and we had a strong leader who really brought us through that. And it's funny, because as I'm saying that, I'm just thinking that so my daughter Laura, her favorite movie is Invictus, which is a it's a, and every time at the end she cries. She's
Ah.
watched it about 20 times, and she still cries at the end of Invictus, as do I,
As
because I
one
mean, I'm
should.
just so grateful that we had, as one should. Because the movie is more than just about the World Cup, right? I mean, it's about that whole notion of how do how do you bring the disparate people together? And even the wisdom that was needed to go against the even the conventional thinking on multiple sides at the time. And that's what we need now, right? We need wisdom to take us beyond sort of the conventional thinking and the politicking that has been so much a symptom of this kind of toxic period that we've gone through, people being so polarized. I mean, even COVID became so politicized, but as did HIV. I mean, it's we shouldn't have been surprised. So we've been through that toxic period, and what we need now is to be thinking of, thinking the big picture. And I do feel quite hopeful, actually, that perhaps the egos can be set aside, and that we can actually do what's right for our country as a whole. And I mean, and I actually feel really excited about the opportunities that we have in terms of healthcare. I mean, if we can get the regulatory enablement and the meeting of the minds that you know, that we are all pulling in the same direction, that, you know, there's so much that we can do. We can do with the not just in terms of how we finance healthcare, but just in terms of how we deliver it. I mean, there's, you know, these developments that are happening and helping us to understand things better and to actually expand access using digital tools and just to support more people having access to care in a sustainable way. So, yeah, as much as it does seem quite desperate at the moment, I think, you know, again, we're at the precipice, and hopefully we're leaning towards the rainbow at the moment. And I think, you know, as South Africans, you know, we are quite resilient. Yeah. And as much as sometimes we get irritated with our country, we do all love each other.
And I think we all realize we have so much to fight for. So we all, you know, we'll do what we can to make it work. And we're also lucky to have people like
yes,
you
exactly.
On the coal face. So thank you for that. All right. So
and you, Pam, too.
No, I'm just a civilian. I watch from the sidelines. So we've spoken through all our books, which were The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Then we spoke about Circle of Friends by Maeve Binchy, Justice by Edwin Cameron, and Animal Farm by George Orwell. So if I had to send you to a desert island with only one of these books, which one would it be?
Only one of the books.
I know, it's
cruel. Well, I think actually it is, but I think then I would have to take the Maeve Binchy book, because it's a fiction escape book. And if I'm stuck on a desert island reading a book, I would want to be escaping into a fictional world rather than trying to work out how to use my time better.
I like that. Let's think of the desert island as the ultimate beach read rather than, you know, we a survival issue. And what are you currently reading?
So I'm currently wading through a Walter Isaacson book.
Okay.
And
biography.
I mean, that's actually one, a book that I never finished was his book on Leonardo. I've still got it. It's actually because it's just such a heavy book. But the one I'm reading at the moment is called Code Breakers, about the team, and specifically Jennifer Doudna, who did the genetic coding in CRISPR. So really, really interesting the depth of the research that he goes into. So it is a bit of a wade through it, but that's what I'm reading at the moment.
Not one for the desert island, poolside or beach reads. And lastly, where can people find you if they'd like to follow your journey?
When you say where can they find me, you mean in terms of from a social media perspective?
Yes. Or if you want to give your home address.
At social media.
You can get.
I live here at 1DP, and sometimes I'm sometimes I'm on East Campus at Wits. But the best is probably to contact me through either my in my Discovery world or my Wits world.
Okay, or the actuarial world. So we'll see you at conventions and seminars. So we're often presenting.
Yes, absolutely.
And yeah, any last thoughts you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, thank you. I mean, I must say it's been a really interesting preparation period for this, and it's nice to you know, to sort of go back and really, because there's so many books, and I thought about it from the point of view of not just the book itself, but you know, where it fitted in with my life and my journey and thoughts that I could share. So thank you for making me be mindful and giving me the space to do that. I mean, the fact that we'd set this up meant that I had to prioritize it, and I really enjoyed doing that prep. So thank you.
Thank you. There's so many more questions I wanted to ask you, but hopefully we can do that in person next time. So thank you so much, Rosanne.
Thanks, Pearl. Thanks for the invite.